We get everything set up here. How y'all doing? Oh, boy, I just got stuff scattered around all over the place. Oh, he said, y'all don't go to work right away when you get there, do you? Get set up here. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic. I've had the gift of sobriety since March 22nd of 1985. And that is truly the biggest gift I've ever had in my life. For a guy like me to stay sober for, 26 months, most like 26 years, is an amazing thing. And I'm real excited to be out here. I remember this place when it was opening, and Tony was, riding around the car with Mark, and they were looking for places and looking for places, and God Almighty, they tried to put it in Wimbledon. It was like they'd pick a spot and it'd blow up, and they'd pick a spot and it'd blow up, and they'd pick a spot, and then finally it was like, I don't think we're supposed to be in Wimbledon, and then they found this place out here, and it's like, surely Maynard's not it, And I laughed when we were pulling up. Mark was my sponsor. And I laughed when we pulled up because I remember him talking about that little house, that little frame house across the street. Have y'all, has everybody seen that? We used to think it was really funny when you'd have some guys fly in from New York or Massachusetts or somewhere, and they're going to be in 90 days of treatment. And they drive out to Maynard, which isn't even said right, And then they'd pull up to that little frame house, and he said, you could always see them go, that's where I'm going to be for 90 days? It looked like a scene from Deliverance. Because you couldn't see the big mansion on the hill back there and all that stuff. And it's been a very cool thing to watch it develop. I gave my sobriety date. You met Katie. I saw Katie's best work, and she really does a good job. I tell you, all bull aside, she's a mighty strong AA member, and man or woman, she's the best at hearing inventory of anybody I've ever seen. I've never seen anybody that can bring it like she does. She's a little generous with her opinion sometimes, and sometimes when it's kind of like getting a drink from a fire hose, you get a little more than you were hoping for. but we are real happy to be AA members, and Paul, nice job, and Gavin, that was where'd Gavin go? There he is. I'll tell you, nice job on the reading. Our story, it says our story is disclosed in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like now. And that's what we'll talk about a little bit up here. But I always wear a coat and tie, or at least a coat. Now, this isn't my regular AA meeting, so I left the tie at home. But anytime I'm behind an AA podium, I always have a coat and tie on. And in my sponsorship lineage, that wasn't optional. It was like, you don't have to want to, but if you're going to get up behind the podium, you wear a coat and a tie. And so I always do, and it may come off pretty soon, but it's always fun. It always feels awkward to me, even sober this long. Before I got to AA, the bulk of my experience wearing a coat and tie, I had a very simple job. My job was to stand there, and when it got to be my turn, I'd say, no contest, Your Honor. We've come a long way. We talk about our own experience. One of the things that makes AA such a big deal is we don't get a new person in and say, here's what you need to do, here's what you need to do. We talk about what we did, and we talk about our own stories, and we talk about what we did, and if you want to do this deal, we'll jump right in with you. But, there's a thing on page 30 where it says, it's on page 18, where it says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Now, here's the key part of that. It says, until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That's how important it is, this identification that takes place of one alcoholic talking to another one. And I was talking to the gentleman from Santa Cruz in the bathroom, and we were talking about, drug-rich environments and stuff, but that identification is so strong with us, it doesn't matter where you put us. That identification takes place in recovery, I mean, when I get with somebody, it's very important that I know that you drank like I drank, or you used like I, because if you drink like I do, you're used to people wanting to talk to you about your drinking, By the time I got here, it had been a common topic of conversation, but it was never. My mother was a first grade school teacher for 42 years, and she had a way, Southern Baptist woman, she had a way of just moving one finger when she would talk to you, and she would say, "You drink every day." And I remember thinking, everybody I know drinks every day, And what I didn't know to tell her was that if drinking did for you what it did for me, you'd be stupid not to drink every day. The first time I drank something big, how many, just for curiosity, how many people in the room remember the first time you got loaded? Do you remember the first time you ever ate green beans? No, because something big happened the first time I got loaded. I remember thinking, oh, we're going to do this a lot. I didn't know it, but from that point forward, it moved right to the center of my life, and everything, my whole existence became about getting loaded. But that identification is so big. Alcoholics Anonymous is a one-trick pony. We're just alcoholics working with alcoholics. And because that identification takes place, we're equipped better than anybody else to talk to another drunk, we talk from our own experience. I get a little nervous. If we're talking at Mark's place, it's a little heady for me. I should warn you in advance, I'm a big guy, into shotguns, I'm into Harley Davidsons, and I'm liable to cry like a little girl in a pink dress up here at any moment, and every once in a while I'll try to float out a little story about Mark, and I'll think, well, this will be safe. I can get by this one, and also it goes, so. And then Katie used to make fun of me because I'd always go. And every time I'd go, didn't see that one coming, but not that you would ever make fun of me. But the reason, we talk from our own experience. I got a little joke I like to tell to get me warmed up, get me kind of in the room. And this, speaking from my own experience, it reminds me of this guy that's driving down a little two-lane farm to market road one day. And some of you have heard this joke, but it's a good joke, and I like the way I'm going to tell it. So here we go. He's driving this little farm to market road, and he sees a sign on the gate of his house, and it says, "Talking dog for sale." He can't stand it. He goes up to the farmer, and he goes, "You got a talking dog for sale?" The guy goes, "Yeah, he's around back." And he walks around back to the farmhouse, and there's this red hound dog laying there, and he goes, he walks up to the dog, and he goes, "So you can talk?" The dog says, "Well, I certainly can." And he goes, "Good grief, how did that happen?" He said, "Well, it started when I was a pup. I started picking up the language from the people I was around. And as I got older, I started developing the nuances of the language and some slang and that sort of thing. And it's really turned into an amazing career for me." So I had a 19-year career in the Drug Enforcement Administration. I was able to infiltrate some situations that no human agent would have ever been able to get into. But beyond that, I've stayed in some of the world's finest hotels. I've eaten with the finest chefs. I've been all over the world. It's just been an amazing career for him. He says, "But even cooler than that," he says, "some of my pups have picked up foreign language skills and have become international diplomats." And but all in all, it's just been a tremendous life. And the guy says, "My God," he says, "it's really been awesome visiting with you." And he goes back around front with that farmer sitting there. He says, "How much do you want for a dog like that?" And the guy goes, "I don't know, $20. And he goes, "Why would you sell a fabulous dog like that for $20? And the farmer goes, "Oh, none of that crap he told you is true." So in AA, it doesn't really matter how good the story is if it's not my experience, So we like to talk from my own experience here. But, let's get rolling. I I grew up in a pretty normal family. I come from Dallas, Texas. I've been in Austin since the mid-70s, but I come from Dallas, and I grew up in a pretty normal family. I mean, I don't know what normal is. I mean, I'm beginning to think normal is just a setting on the washing machine, but I will say that there wasn't anything that weird going on in our house. I mean, both my parents were getting up going to work every day, and nobody was knocking each other around. I mean, I've heard enough fifth steps over the years to know that there's an awful lot of people that had it a heck of a lot worse than I had it growing up. You know, it was a pretty good situation. I did grow up under the burden of potential, though. I heard a lot about anybody else grow up under the burden of potential. Oh my God, I was always hearing about, you know, why can't you live up to your potential? You know, why can't you be more like Charles Mollier across the street if you would just apply yourself? And that's the thing. And I remember thinking, it's pretty flattering, Mom, but I'm really not holding back that much. Kind of getting my best shot here, you know, but whether my family was good or bad affected the way I react to life and the way I am in school and the way I'm around people and some of my skills and stuff like that, but it didn't cause my alcoholism, you know. And I thought for a long time, and most of us get here trying to figure out why was I an alcoholic, and none of that stuff caused it. You know, and I'm really, the longer I'm around this deal, if I make it to March, I'll be sober 27 years. And I'm beginning to think it's more and more a genetic bullet, you know, and you catch it or you don't. But I mean, I'm alcoholic, and my sister isn't. And so I don't know what the difference is, but on page 30 in our book, it says, we learned that we had to fully conceive to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. It says it's the first step in recovery. There's a lot going on in that sense. I'm a big book guy. I'm an unapologetic big book thumper. I like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's because I've been on both sides of that fence. And I've seen the results of meeting-based sobriety, and I've seen the results of big book-based sobriety, and I'm a big fan of big book-based sobriety. So I like to break it down all the time. And when it says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics, there's a lot going on in that sentence, because there's a lot, you know, I've been walking around for years going, you know, I must be an alcoholic. I mean, I didn't know exactly what an alcoholic was, but if there is such a thing, I'm surely one, you know, because nobody got more loaded than I did until I met some guys around here that, you know, ran it a little harder than I did, but I didn't know anybody. You know, it's funny, this is not an AA meeting. When I talk in AA meetings, well, I don't ever talk about anything other than alcohol. And I always talk about outside issues, you know, as the drugs, but I'll say drugs here and there. But the shortest version of my story is that the guys that I drank with thought that I did too many drugs. And the guys that I did drugs with were shocked by my drinking. So everybody thought Charlie was getting all too loaded. I always related to, there's a big rock band that they all got sober, and they said in an interview one time that they knew that they were in trouble when the guys from Motley Crue told them, you guys need to back it down a little bit. I was thinking about Keith Richards the other day, and there was this guy that he was, Graham Parsons, but Keith Richards was trying to help him get sober. And it just made me laugh, because I was going, you know how jacked up you got to be before Keith Richards goes, dude, we got to get you some help. You know? Keith Richards was a superstar, man. I mean, in order for me to admit to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic, I got to know what it means to be an alcoholic. And all alcoholism is, what I've come to believe, and the book does a beautiful job of describing it in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story and the first really 43 pages of the book. But the shortest version I know is that I got two problems with alcohol. What makes me alcoholic is I got two problems with alcohol. One happens to me when I drink it, and one happens to me when I don't drink it. Other than that, I really got no problem with alcohol. It only gives me trouble when I drink it or when I don't drink it. And the book does a beautiful job of describing it, but there's something that happens to me when I drink alcohol. It doesn't happen to my sister. My sister's not alcoholic, never will be. I couldn't pour enough vodka in my sister to make her an alcoholic. I could get her drunk. I could put her behind the wheel of a car and she could get a DWI, right? But when she sobered up, she would not be one of us. Those circumstances are not what makes me alcoholic. Some of that stuff is just what happens to people that drink a lot. I mean, we will admit that there's probably somebody sitting in jail tonight that went to a party this afternoon, had too many drinks, got pulled over, got a DWI, but they're not alcoholic. Does that make sense? Well, if you can get a DWI without being an alcoholic, then obviously getting DWIs is not what makes me alcoholic, or going to jail, or not going to jail, because we have a wide range of experience in AA members. But what does make me alcoholic is that I got this weird reaction to alcohol, that when I drink it, it triggers a craving for more booze. The book calls it the phenomenon of craving, but for me, all I know is that when I take a drink, another drink is imperative. And the third drink is coming right behind that one, and by the time I get to the ninth drink, it sounds like a better idea than the second one did. And that doesn't happen. You know, the book talks about that craving only happens to one of us. It's a big problem. Not my biggest problem. If my biggest problem was what happens when I drink, what would my solution be? Don't drink, right? Nancy Reagan's little Just Say No program would have been awesome, you know? I mean, you know, but anybody have any luck with that? This is Your Brain on Drugs? That one was a real deterrent, wasn't it? You guys probably don't remember that one, but boy, you know, it's fried egg in a pan, and, you know, This Is Your Brain on Drugs. You're like, no, dude, that's breakfast, you know? Let's go to Denny's. You know, but what happens is, it's the second piece, when I stop drinking, something happens. I'll say this because we've got a lot of family members here tonight. And you know, it's funny, when I would come off a run, and I would promise that I was never going to do this again, it felt like I meant it. And whenever we would get here, most of us, if you've asked me, why did I do it again? Why did I go on another run? We'd give them the only answer we had, which is what? I don't know, man. I don't know. God, that's just what I do, I guess. I screw up. I'm a screw up, and that's what I do, you know. And that's why a lot of us can get here thinking there's something wrong with us, because when I would promise that I wasn't ever going to do this again, it felt like I meant it with every fiber of my being. In fact, somewhere along the line, we crossed an invisible line where I lost the power of choice and control. I don't know when it happened. I think that's why they call it an invisible line. But somewhere along the line, I lost the power, choice, and control. It says, the idea that he'll one day control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every alcoholic. Woo! I could either control it, but I wasn't enjoying it, or I could enjoy it, but I wasn't controlling it. But I could control and enjoy my drinking. And, you know, somewhere along the line, you know, I didn't start drinking till I was 16. You know, it's funny because I used to be really young. You know, I mean, when I first came out, you know, 16 was pretty young to start drinking. Now it's not even young to stop. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, you know, seriously, you know, it's like you see a guy and you're like, hey, are you here, you know, with your folks or something? No, I'm here to pick up a 90-day chip. You know, and you're like, rock on, dude. I much love for young people in AA. I'm not busting on anybody, but for me, I didn't start drinking until I was 16 years old, and I didn't really need this program until I was probably 17 years old. I didn't have a long career of controlled drinking, you know. I was kind of all about getting loaded from the very beginning. Drinking was never a beverage for me. It was always a drug delivery system. I was always, and it's funny because I've said for years, you know, the addict, alcoholic thing, I don't care, but I've always felt like my problem was alcoholism. And the book says, you know, our bottles were but a symptom. I had a lot of other symptoms. There's a lot of things I did to treat my alcoholism besides drink alcohol. And I didn't miss much. I don't, you know, it'd be real macho to stand up here and tell you that I drank a fifth of whiskey every day from the time I was 16 until I sobered up at the age of 28, but that wouldn't be true. But what I can tell you, and this isn't everybody's story in AA. There's a lot of people that held it together a lot better than I did. But from the time I was 16 until the time I was 28, I can honestly promise you that I never one time turned down the opportunity to get loaded. Never one time under any circumstances. There was never a time when you could pull something out and I'd go, oh, you know, it's my mother's birthday today, you know, or something like that. It just, I didn't have that in me, you know. And that's why, and some of this treatment center talk, it always kills me. One of the terms you hear is drug of choice. Have you heard that one? That one just cracks me up. That always makes me giggle a little bit, you know, when they say, what was your drug of choice? Because, I mean, can you imagine, did anybody talk like that out there? I mean, did anybody, you know, can you imagine being at a party somewhere and somebody going, look, you know, and going, oh, well, I'm sure that's nice for you. Doesn't happen to be my particular drug of choice. You boys, go ahead. I'm just going to sit over here and wait for my drug of choice. It's like, you know, whatever you got will be fine, you know. Up, down, sideways, backwards, I don't care, but let's go, you know. And but I went through different periods of different things. But, you know, it's trying to get, you know, and the thing about drugs and alcohol is it says, while we admit it's injurious, after a while I can't tell the truth from the false. You know, one of the ways I can't, this was a doctor's opinion, one of the ways I can't tell the truth from the false is I'm the guy that's sitting in his third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh treatment center, and I'm telling myself, I'm not like these guys. When I get out of here, I can tweak this deal just a little bit, and I think I can still make it work. You know, when there's very little evidence from my history or what anybody else is witnessing in my life to support the idea that I'm fixing to get a handle on it. Does that make sense? That's one of the ways I can't tell the truth from the false. Since my alcoholic life seems the only normal one. But, you know, I get into this area where I've lost the power of choice and control. It started getting a little sloppy. You know, one night I left a bar at a blackout. And I was a blackout drinker. I was a regular blackout drinker. I was blacking out a few times a week. You know, any other blackout drinkers? My people, all right, don't be afraid. You know, well, Katie was a brownout drinker. You know, she didn't black out much, but she brown. Well, of course, you know, I found out later that she was in much more vulnerable condition to, in a blackout than I ever was. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on that, but never really worried about anybody trying to have sex with me while I was blacked out. I was selling; they just weren't buying. You know? But, you know, I lost power of choice control pretty early on, and I tried to run it for a long time. And the story I like to tell about the loss of the power of choice and control, it's just the second thing, this mental obsession that comes when I haven't been drinking for a while. Because if you're an alcoholic like I am, when I stop drinking, my problems don't go away. Right? When I stop drinking, I don't get okay. In fact, it seems like somebody turned up the volume on my problems a little bit. After 2 or 3 weeks, I started getting a little jumpy. You know, I started getting a little restless. I started getting a little like a dog circling the room that can't find his spot. You know, if I'm outside walking around, it feels like I ought to be inside sitting down. If I'm inside sitting down, it feels like I ought to be laying down somewhere else. But I just never feel quite right. I get a little irritable, right? A little irritable. And you may have witnessed this with some of your brothers and sisters in treatment after a few weeks. You know, I mean, I don't really get irritable, right? I mean, because irritable is uncool, you know? But, I mean, it's not my fault if I just become keenly aware of how stupid everybody else is. You know what I mean? After a little while where, you know, my boss is stupid and the guy I work with is stupid and my roommate and the people in traffic are way stupid, you know, and the people going slower than me are idiots and the people going faster than me are maniacs. And I got the perfect speed. And the guy in the grocery store has got 14 items on the 10-item lane, and the way I know that is because I counted everything. You know, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I get when I haven't had a drink in a while. And after a while, I need some relief, right? I need some relief. And when I need relief, I can't think about consequences. Real alcoholics don't stay sober because of consequences. Real alcoholics don't stay sober because of what will happen if they drink again. We don't stay sober because of what happened the last time I drank. So it always cracks me up when we have, well, it doesn't crack me up, it pisses me off. When we have a new guy come in and they say, well, we're going to have a step one meeting. And what does everybody do? They sit around and tell war stories about all the bad stuff that happened to them. And they're like, we're going to scare this new guy into getting sober. Well, on page 24, it says, I won't be able to call to mind my own suffering and humiliation with sufficient force to keep me sober. Why would I care what happened to Cecil? You know, it's not like I'm going to be reaching for the cooler and go, oh, wait a minute, you heard that story Cecil told me. You don't want any of that, brother, you know. I don't have that in me, you know. I don't. When I need relief, it's all bets are off. And you know, the story I like to tell, I'm going to have to hurry up, but the story I like to tell is I was a big fan of pawn shops. I love pawn shops. I love the whole equation of pawn shops because it's a very simple and pure equation. You know, you walk in there, there's no application process. You don't have to prove yourself to anybody. You walk in with a deer rifle, and they give you the money. And then you walk in with a shotgun, and they give you the money. And you walk in with the coin collection, and they go, I've never had a pawnbroker go, what are you going to do with this money? You know, or, good God, man, weren't you just in here this morning? You know, it was never like that, you know? Now, the weak part of this plan, and we drops make some brilliant plans. I mean, we really do. We really do. We make some plans that you could take over to the UT School of Business, and they'd look it over and go, pretty damn good plan, you know? And our plans work right up to the point that they quit working, you know? Part of my plan was that I had 90 days. I should point out to you that I didn't own very much stuff. So I was having to pawn stuff that didn't belong to me. And that complicates the equation a little bit. It causes hard feelings in your family and that sort of thing. But I had a plan because I wasn't just selling stuff. It was, you had 90 days to go pull some sort of a scan and you get everything out of the pawn shop and I'd go get everything back and I would take it, you know, and put it back where it belonged and then, you know, like that. And my plan worked great. Until it quit working, you know. And one day, I pulled an insurance scam, and I came up with enough money to get everything out of the pawn shop. Everything, you know. And I just stopped by the Spillway Pub. I was just going to have a couple of drinks, right? I wasn't going to get drunk. I'm just going to stop by and see the boys and settle my tab at the Spillway Pub, because it's the only place in Dallas at the time that was letting me run a tab. And I would stop. I'd go in there. I'm just going to have, well, I came out of a five-day blackout. After that, I didn't have many of those. I had a lot of overnight blackouts, but this was 5 days of don't remember anything. And when I came out of that blackout, I had $8. I was sitting on the edge of the bed at my mother's house. I should point out to you that I was so poorly treated as a child that I finally ran away from home for good at the age of 28. I'm serious. Never went back. I was in and out, but I always land back at my parents' house. But I come out of this blackout on the edge of the bed at my mother's house, and I had $8 in my right front pocket, and in my left front pocket I had this gangster wad of pawn tickets. I still had all the pawn tickets, and I'm coming out of a blackout, and the book talks about it, where it's just emerging from a spree, remorseful, with a firm resolution not to do it again. And we've all had those mornings, you know, where you wake up and you just go, oh, no, because my dad was a good man, you know, and nobody was giving him his stuff, and here's his son out pawning it, you know, and stuff like that. I knew enough to know that was not right, but, I mean, I wasn't trying to lose it. I had a plan, and here now my plan is blown up, and I shot my wad with the last insurance scam, and I got nothing left, right? I got nothing. And I would have to go to my dad and say, Dad, if we act now, I can get you a pretty good deal on all your stuff. But if we wait till tomorrow, it's strictly retail. And you know, for the family members that are in the room, I'm sensitive to that. We know that's not funny. We know that's not funny. Every one of us knows that desperation of knowing that I've screwed it up again, and there's no friendly direction. You know, either I got to go to my dad and tell him, or I got to let his stuff go. And we know enough to know that I have to tell them like it's a joke or I'll start crying about that. Because what would happen was that we would get in the car with me, and this was in Dallas. Dallas is a big town. You know, it wasn't like just going to the pawn shop. We've got to go out on Garland Road and get the shotgun. We've got to go out on Buckner Boulevard and get your metal detectors. We've got to go to Beltline Road to get the coin collection and your deer rifles in Oak Cliff and on. And so it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. You know, and when we'd be riding around in that car, I'd be saying, Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again. You know, and I meant it. If I was lying to that man, I damn sure didn't know it. Because it felt to me like I meant it with every fiber of my being, that I will never do this again. What I didn't know at the time was what we mean by a hopeless state of mind and body. What I didn't know at the time was that I didn't have the power to make good on that promise. When I was promising him that I would never do that again, I might as well have promised him that I was going to flap my arms up here and fly around the parking lot out there and come back in Atlanta, because I did not have the power to not get loaded again. Because I would swear to him I'd never do it again, and within 2 or 3 days I'd hit the back door of his house like a cat burglar, and we'd be off and running again. And all I can tell you is that before I got to AA, my dad and I made the rounds of the pawn shops 3 times. And that's just the times when I couldn't pull it together again. Now, my dad originally went to Al-Anon. My mother didn't. I can still work my mother like a rented mule. My dad stopped playing, but I'll never forget. I got to tell you the story for your family members. You people in treatment are not going to appreciate me telling this story. especially if your folks are here. You're over there going, right after I sobered up, my sister was getting married. I never tell this story. My sister was getting married. And I called my mother, and I'm telling you, I could work my mother, you know. And I called her up, and I said, you know, Mom, can you see it coming already? Yeah, you know, here we go. And I go, you know, Mom, in Texas, you know, it's okay to wear boots with a tuxedo. You know, you really can. And what I was thinking was, instead of renting those rubber shoes, we'd get me a pair of boots, and then I'd have them, you know, after the wedding, right? Solid plan, right? And my mother says, well, okay, yeah, she used to go, so here we go. I'm out boot shopping now. And I come back, and I call the house, and my dad answers the phone. So I have to bring him up to speed on the conversation that mother and I had, you know, and I tell him the whole thing. I go, now, my dad's been going to Al-Anon meetings. And I said, Dad, here's the deal. And I said, now listen, I found a pair of Dan Post lizard boots that I really like. They're $175. I said, but the ones I really like are these Lucchese elephants. They're $400, but they are really nice. And my dad, with zero hesitation, goes, son, I want you to have the best boots that money can buy. He says, I don't care whether they're $200 or $400 or even $1,000, just as long as you can afford them. I'm like, that was my first experience with Al-Anon, you know. And so if you're trying to decide, I tell you, with my experience of working with drunks and working with Al-Anons and the significant family members of us, it's many times harder to get an untreated Al-Anon to go to the meetings than it is to get the drunk to go. Because my mother, she didn't go to Al-Anon because she didn't need to, right? It wasn't her problem. My mother is not against, my mother's 88 years old and has still not made her first mistake yet. I mean, you know, she's not against the idea of apologizing. It's just never come up for her. You know? She wasn't fixing to go to Al-Anon. My dad, they worked miracles with my dad. I mean, they changed my dad's whole outlook on life. So, you know, I highly recommend, if you've got a significant family member in treatment, go to 6 Al-Anon meetings. I'm not a representative of Al-Anon. I'm a member of AA. But don't go to 1 or 2, because they're going to suck at first. You're going to think, I don't belong here. I'm not like these people. Just like our fellowship. If you gave every AA member a flag to wave, where's Clancy at? I told you I was going to quote Clancy. Clancy's one of the biggest. It's funny when he said his name was Clancy. I was like, oh, I'll probably quote Clancy now. But Clancy's this guy in California, 53 years sober. He's one of my heroes. And he said, if you gave every one of us a flag to wave when we get here, every one of our flags would say the same thing. It would say, you don't understand. My case is different. You don't understand. My case is different. And there's something that happens in this step one experience when you see somebody come in and they got all, because most of us are sitting there going, I ain't got it like these guys, you know? And I don't know anybody that's ever walked into an AA meeting and looked up at those steps. And, you know, has anybody walked into an AA club for your first meeting and looked up there at those steps on the wall and gone, that ought to do it? Yeah. You know, because if you knew how complicated and complex my situation was, you'd be embarrassed to give me your hinky little 12-step thing. But there is something that happens. The reason the book spends almost half of the recovery text talking about what it means to be an alcoholic is because we're not going anywhere until that guy has what I call a step one experience. It's where they go, hold on just a minute. What you're saying explains a lot of stuff I've never been able to explain before. And this physical allergy explains why whenever I start drinking, it always gets away from me. And this mental obsession piece explains why whenever I stop drinking. See, the thing about that allergy and what happens when I take that first drink, one of the things I've never thought about was every time I ever took that first drink that triggers the phenomenon of craving, I was stone cold sober. I can't blame the first drink on being loaded. I make the craziest decision in my life, the decision to try to take another run at it, I make that decision stone cold sober. That's how uncomfortable I get when I stop drinking. Right? So that's why, you know, and that, there's something that happens. So when we talk about a hopeless state of mind and body, you know, it talks about I got a body that'll never respond properly. I mean, there is no good news at the end of step one. Right? This would be a really sucky program if we only had one step. I mean, can you imagine? And we get Paul in here, we go, okay, Paul, here's the deal. You're not picking on you, but I'm just looking at you. Yeah. You got a body that don't respond regular to booze, right? When you drink, it's always going to get away from you. You know, it's a big problem, not your biggest problem. You also got a mind that is always going to convince you to get loaded again. Every time, every time, every time. Really sorry. Try to have a nice day, you know. But that's it. And step one is the deal. In step one is that on my own power, I got no shot. I got no shot. It's like me stepping into the ring with Mike Tyson. You know, I couldn't beat him with a pocket knife. I got no shot of stopping drinking on my own power. And there's something that happens because I'm not going to be interested in this other power until I believe that my own power is not going to get the job done, right? So anyway, cool. Well, took a little time on that one, didn't we, honey? Well, I came into AA and I worked the steps the first time, and it was a little, I had my biggest spiritual awakening at 17 years of sobriety. So I should tell you that what happened with me was, my first time in, I didn't know I was hitching my wagon to middle-of-the-road sobriety, middle-of-the-road AA. I thought I was doing AA. I was going. Most of us think it's getting sober, it means not drinking and going to those meetings. Now, if you're out here, you're getting a different message. But let me tell you, it's not the message being carried everywhere. There's a lot of places that want to talk to you about your triggers and your and things like that. Believe me, we can move you beyond triggers, right? Yeah, I mean, what they told me, what Mark told me, was that if anything will make you drink, you'll drink over anything. And, you know, and he said a lot more than that. He used to like to say, how do you know what you don't know? And I've been in AA for a long time, and one of the biggest mistakes I see being made in AA is if you take me right from seeing that God could and would if he ever saw to then let's do the third step prayer and get down on our knees and do the third step prayer and then start writing the inventory. And if you do that, you miss this body of work from pages 60 to 63 that's not very important. It's just the root of our problem and the basis of our work for the rest of our lives. The book takes a huge right turn on page 60, and I missed it for 17 years. And I worked a program like the problem was alcohol. You know, and it was, and you guys that have been in the meetings for a while, you know that guy. You know, it's the guy that's going, well, I screamed at my wife on the way out of the house this morning and slapped one of the kids, burned out of the driveway, got to work 2 hours late and looked at porn on the internet, and gambled on the way home, got a half gallon of Bluebell and ate it in the car before I came inside, but I didn't drink today, and by God, that makes me a winner. And you're like, no, that makes you an asshole, dude. But there's more to this program than not drinking, you know? And there's a line on page 19 that blew my mind the first time I saw it. It says, this is after this last time in, it says, we feel that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. Listen to this line. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. But when you're working a program like this about not drinking, how can anything be a much more important demonstration of our principles than not drinking? I thought that was the finish line, right? You know, if you don't drink, you're a winner, and that sort of thing. Well, turns out what happened is, I don't know, I'm going to skip through some of this stuff, but I spent a lot of years in AA suffering from untreated alcoholism, you know, and I was not drinking, and I was going to those meetings, and you see, how many people in treatment have been in AA before? That was shocking news to me when I got here. That it took me a while to get to treatment. When I got here and they were talking about how many of you have been here before, I was like, what? It took me 9 months to get here. I don't want to come again. You know, it was shocking to me to find out. But this untreated, just going to meetings, if you got alcoholism the way we got it, treating it by just going to meetings will keep you sober right up to the point that you get drunk. A guy like me, I'll get a little relief, and that's what I was doing. I was doing what I had come to call meeting-based sobriety, and I didn't know I was doing it, but I didn't know I was in it, but it's where I'm not really working the program, I'm not really practicing the principles of the program, but I'm not drinking, and if I really screw up, I'll do a 10 step, that sort of thing, and then I go to the 5:30 meeting, and I get a little relief from the 5:30 meeting, and I go back to living a life based completely on selfishness and self-centeredness, and by 5:30 tomorrow afternoon, by God, I need a meeting. You know, and I go to the meeting then, and I get a little relief, and I go back in the world, and I'm practicing, you know, a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness. And I need another meeting tomorrow. But what happens is, going to those meetings, I'll get a little relief, but I never experience freedom. I never experience the freedom that comes as a result of working the steps of this program right out of the big book with somebody who's worked the steps of this program right out of the big book. And what happened with Katie and I've been in a dishonest marriage, and short version of that is the most dishonest thing in that marriage was me. And I was commuting between here and Manhattan, and it all looked good from the outside. We had a beach house in the Hamptons, a penthouse in Manhattan, and it was as funny as a $3 bill. But I'm rolling this deal, and one night we charter a flight to fly from the Hamptons back into LaGuardia, and we're going to go to dinner, and the plane, the engine quits. We are up about 3,000 feet, and the engine quits. And we said we're going to have to ditch. And it was a little six-seater Cessna, and we have to set it in the water at night. And I'm telling the shortest version I can, but we hit the water, and we had a pretty good landing. And but it's like splashdown at Six Flags times 1,000. You know, I mean, you're approaching the water and then you hit, and it's nothing but spray and noise and all this racket. And the windshield came in, and the cowling came off, and then absolute silence. You know, and all of a sudden I'm going, my God, I think we're going to be okay, right? Well, this wasn't much of an airplane, but it was a really crappy boat. And so right about the time you're going, I think we're going to be okay, I feel something on my knee, and it's water, and it goes up like that. And I go up to get some air, and there's nothing but water on the roof of that plane. And we're underwater, and my door won't open, and nobody's doors will open, and that's where I'm thinking, so that's it. I'm going to die in this airplane. You know, and well, we got to, and I survived, in case you're wondering. But the door came open, and I got out, and I got my wife out, the wife at the time, and I got the, and anyway, long story short, everybody, so all five adults survived, and the only non-survivor was our dog. And but it's okay, you know, I mean, I can get another dog, and we're on Anderson Cooper, CNN, and all that stuff, and what, I say all this, because an event like that will make you look at things differently. And, can I go and look up on that? Because what happens is, I started looking at things differently then. I started looking at the way I was really, the principles I was really living my life by, you know, because I've been trying to just get myself okay. And I remember I called up John Henry one time and I said, John Henry, I'm so self-centered. I can't even be in a conversation with anybody. I mean, you know, I have to force myself to go, hey, Jonathan, how are the kids? You know, and act like I give a flip. Not talking, but I'm just using that. You know, I have to act like I give a flip about the answer because I don't, because I'm obsessed with myself. That's alcoholism. It's selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. That's I could talk for another 2 hours about the level of self-centeredness that I carry around even in sobriety. At 15 years sober, I walked into the AA club one time and this guy goes, hey, Charlie, how you doing? He goes, we need to go back out to Vegas sometime. And I turned around and I was horrified because I had zero recollection of ever being in Vegas with this guy. And I was 12, 14 years sober when I went to Vegas. The more I thought about it, I realized that there was four of us that went out there, and the reason that I didn't remember it is because I wasn't in Vegas with that guy. I was in Vegas with me. And he just happened to be along for the ride, and he could have been anybody, right? Because I had zero recollection. He was me and me and me and me, and that's alcoholism. It turns out alcohol never was my problem. Alcohol was the only thing I ever found that would give me relief from a life based completely on selfishness and self-centeredness. That's what the book talks about in pages 60 to 63, and I missed it for 17 years. A friend of mine went to La Hacienda, and he met this one-eyed guy down there that was pretty much of a big book thumper, and he told him about a group up in Dallas called the Primary Purpose Group. And Tom started going to the Primary Purpose Group, and then I went up there with him, and then, one time, I heard about this conference. Katie and I heard about this conference, and there was a guy named Mark H. that was doing a conference, and we went to it. You know, it's like, and it was so peculiar because I mean, we wouldn't have even really been interested in going to a Big Book meeting, and this is Big Book weekend. What? You know, I mean, Friday night, all day Saturday, Sunday morning. Oh, let's please raise a big book. But we go up there, and here's this guy, Mark Houston. And that's him right there. That picture was taken in the morning. He was going on Dr. Phil's show not too long before he died. But we go in, he's very much alive this day. And we go in there, and I mean, he was up there leading this workshop, and he was saying stuff that I had never heard before. I mean, I'm 17 years sober, and I'm going, good God, man, what book are you reading from? You know? I've never heard any of this stuff you're talking about. It was a level of AA. You know, I'll never forget, he called this poor bastard up to the front, and he says, yeah, his name is Paul. I'm not making this up. And he calls him up there, and he goes, Paul, tell me. He says, do you meditate? And the guy goes, well, he says, I'm a truck driver, see? And sometimes I meditate when I'm driving. You know, Mark used to say, you can ask, you know, you can't get an alcoholic to answer a yes or no question. You know? So you can ask an alcoholic if they're married, and you get a five-minute answer. You know? But this guy says, well, I'm a truck driver, see? He goes, and sometimes I meditate when I'm driving the truck. You know, I'm driving. And Mark goes, okay, two things, Paul. First of all, when you're driving the truck, we very much need you to be about driving the truck. We don't want you meditating while you're hurling down the highway at 65 miles an hour. Second of all, in the future, when I ask you a yes or no question, I'm going to expect a yes or no answer. He said, so I'm going to ask you one more time if you meditate, and it's very important to me for you to say no. And Katie and I were sitting out there going, woo, I'm glad he didn't call me up. I wouldn't have passed that one either, you know, but it started a journey with us You know, and Mark wound up moving to Austin not too long ago, and I'd been working with Myers, Chris's twin brother. When Mark moved here, I started working with Mark, and I'm telling you, it took my AA to a level that I never even knew was there. You know, we started working with guys. We started a meeting at my house we called the Common Solution, and it was amazing that Mark made such a priority of that meeting, because it was Mark at one end of the table and me at the other end of the table and all my sponsees every Thursday night. And it's far and away the best AA I've ever been involved with in my life. I mean, the meeting there, that kitchen table AA, we were taking it to a depth that I never knew was there, you know. And I can go on and on about Mark, but I can tell you that since then, what has happened and made in Katie's life and in my life has been a wholesale miracle. I mean, we spoke at 32 conferences last year, and believe me, 7 or 8 years ago, nobody wanted to hear what we had to say, you know, and there was an experience that has taken place that inspires other people to get into this level of work and a new deal, and the ripple effect of that experience that we had with Mark, there's no way to calculate it, you know, and we were talking, Katie was talking to Mark out on the back porch one day, and she talked about us being at that workshop, and Mark goes, "Do you really think you had anything to do with being there?" I mean, really, he says, "God just channeled you guys in the direction of growth that you needed to go to, and there we are in front of Mark Houston." The reason I mention the conferences is because everywhere I go, people come, I always talk about Mark, and people always come up to me. I've had at least 50 people come up to me and say, "Mark Houston changed my life, and I never even met him." All these are people that just listen to him on CD. The message he was bringing had so much depth and weight that if you're an alcoholic like I am, it was undeniable truth. It hit me right there, and there was no getting around it. I almost missed it. If I'd have died in that plane crash 9 years ago, I would have thought I knew what AA had to offer me. If you'd have come to me and said, "Charlie, what is going to change your life and set you on fire is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous right out of the big book," I would have told you, "You're full of it," because I've been in AA for 17 years. And I know what AA has to offer me. I've never dipped a toe in the water. I'm a Dallas Cowboy fan. I assume we all are. I mean, I've been a fan since they were good. I used to have season tickets and stuff, and one night the sponsee goes, "Hey man," he goes, "my family's got a skybox at Texas State, and you ever want to go to a game?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, well, good for you, I'm sure." You know. And one day he calls me up and he goes, "Hey man, you want to go see the Philadelphia game in the skybox?" And I said, "Absolutely, yes I do." And so we go to Texas Stadium, and we go into a little private parking lot. We go in through a private little entrance. We go up this civilized little staircase. And we go down a quiet little hallway. And we go into this skybox. And there's waiters with cookies and ice and stuff like that. I didn't know whether to be excited about being there or pissed off for sitting in the cheap seats for 20 years. That was exactly my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I had died in that plane crash, I would have thought that was all AA had to offer. It turns out there's a level of the game going on that I had never stuck a toe in. There's people working this program at a level that I never imagined, and now we are right in the middle of it. You know, it goes on at our house every Monday night, every Thursday night, a primary purpose group on Tuesday night. You know, I'm carrying this message, and I'm telling you, the only thing more exciting than having a message of recovery is being able to deliver a message of recovery. You know, when somebody comes up to you and says, "I'm in trouble, man, can you show me?" There was a time it would have been a bunch of slogan slinging and bullshit and telling them to go to more meetings and stuff like that. Now we got a message of depth and weight. If you need help, I'd say exactly, absolutely, I can show you what we did. You got a big book? If you don't have a big book, we'll get you one. And we walk right through that book, and then 2 months later you look up and that new guy has got his new guy, and they're sitting there with the big book knee to knee, and that's the best stuff there is. If you're in this treatment center, or if you're fairly new, all I can tell you is it's still available. It's available as a result of the work right out of this big book. if you get with somebody who, I know you're hearing the message out here, this is not a watered-down, middle-of-the-world treatment center. I mean, in a lot of AA community, what the book calls our common solution, our meeting on Thursday night with Mark was called the common solution, because we talk about the common solution. The common solution is not always the common solution out there in some of those meetings. And if you study this book, you'll know bullshit when you hear it. You know, so get with somebody who's done this work, and you can't even imagine, you know. The book says the most satisfying years of our existence lie ahead of us. If you've been sober a while, ask yourself, does your experience reflect that? Does it look like that's the way it's going to be? I'd like to close with one little thing out here. I miss Mark. He sat at our table one Thursday night, and he said, I'll never forget, I can still see him saying it. He said, I want to go out like my heroes. I want to go out current in the work. I want to be sponsoring guys. I want to be current on my amends. I want to be out doing the work. I don't think he meant tomorrow afternoon, but that's the way it worked out. He got up and he went to Houston the next day, and he died that afternoon. He was a superstar in the AA community. I've never known anybody with that level of clarity. Being able to tap into that. Page 100 of our big book says, and I'm going to close with this. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things that came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. The reason it says when we look back is because if you're like me, God's will always looks like it's a little bit of a jip. You know, am I the only one? It always seems like I can get myself a little bit better deal than God's going to give me. But it says when we look back, we see that the things that came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you'll presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what.